session number 15479, reel 6.
And just before we disappeared behind a hill, he saw this red Very pistol. So
he had no alternative but to press the panic button, send fire engines and ambulances and goods and so forth to the scene. Of course, he didn't see us climb away the other side. And as a result of that, I was court-martialed for low flying and dismissed the service. So I came out of the Air Force a little sooner than I would have done otherwise. And also, of course, having flown over Scarborough,
the tail end of the trip, it was my misfortune that there was an open-air concert on, attended by the Chief Constable and the Mayor. And whereas a month or two before they would have said, "There go our marvellous heroes," it was, "There go those Nazi so-and-sos." And it was reported through police channels, and so I didn't stand a chance. I was found guilty and kicked out. I'd forgotten the reason I was saying all that story, actually, but there's an interesting sideline. Right, now, where are we? The airlift.
I joined British South American
Airways in August 1948. I'd flown for
a couple of charter companies before that.
And shortly afterwards, the British South American Airways, BSAA, were asked to participate in the Burling airlift. They were short of aircraft. They'd only recently introduced the 2-4 on the South Atlantic. So they were given 2-1s by the Air Ministry, I believe. I think they were built initially for BOSC. And BOSC had done some initial acceptance trials on them and didn't particularly like them. They were a short fuselage. They were quite a tricky aircraft to take off. They had bad swing on takeoff. The range wasn't very good and the load wasn't very good, so I think I'm right in saying they didn't want them. So they were just sort of hanging around, and so they thought this would be a good aircraft to put on the airlift. They were also short of captains, so they grabbed some experienced first officers, gave them a quick conversion, and made them temporary captains. So I found myself, within a month of joining BSAA, on the airlift. We flew out there to Wunstorf. They were short of accommodation, so all they could do was stick us in the attics of the what had been a Luftwaffe sergeant's mess. And then we started on the airlift, flying initially dry goods, flour, coal, you mentioned it. And we would come off the aircraft having done 3 round trips, black or white as the case may be. You can imagine the dust that was created in the aircraft with all this on board. And then after a time, they introduced 2-5s, which were the long fuselage version. At Wunstorf, once we'd settled in, we then started operating into Gatow, which is one of the airfields at Berlin. I believe there were flights from about 8 different places. including a flying boat operation into Havel. But we were doing the Wunstorf Gatto, and there were landings at Gatto every 3 minutes, and it was absolutely spit-second timing. If for any reason at all you couldn't make it, but say the weather wasn't too bright and you broke cloud and you were not properly lined up, there's no question of saying, oh well, we'll go round again. You just had to fly straight ahead and back to Wunstorf. They couldn't possibly fit in a landing off an aborted landing. And we used to do three flights, three round trips. We'd be operating 12 hours on and 24 hours off. And in that time, in that 12 hours, you could do three round trips. It was roughly just over an hour each way. And then by the time they'd offloaded and you got back, another hour back to Wunstorf, and then the loading. So they could only just get three trips in. And there were three crews, so it was a routine. And the length of time we were out in Germany was depended on the maintenance of the aircraft. We had to fly back after every, let me see, 300 hours, I think it was. Once the aircraft had done 300 hours, it had to go back to base for routine maintenance. So then we'd fly it back and have a few days off while this was, whilst the maintenance was being done, and then fly back out again, and back to the routine of three round trips in 12 hours, 24 hours off. So if you did, say for the sake of argument, midday to midnight, and then your next one, you'd come on at midnight. It worked out quite well. It wasn't too arduous. But this question of sticking to time was really critical. There were beacons on the run in. We had to keep strictly to the corridors, the 20-mile wide corridors into Gatto. If you wandered off, then you'd be intercepted by a MiG and forced to land in East Germany. So it was imperative you stayed in the middle of the corridor, which was no great problem, because, as I say, because we had these radio beacons and you could home in, and the route was the same all the time, and you'd call up over the various beacons. And the thing I thought was great about it was the repartee on the RT. I wish I'd kept a closer record of it, because some of it, especially from the Americans, was absolutely marvelous. The only one I ever remember, and which I used to repeat, was the American coming in, probably from Hamburg or somewhere like that, in his Skymaster, who had a girlfriend who worked sometimes in the tower. So he called up and he said, is Mabel on the tower? And the very British voice came back and said, yes, she's in the tower. And he said, the American said, can she hear me? And the British voice said, well, she's got a headset on. He said, well, I got boots on, but I ain't walking. And there was so much of this. It was spontaneous, but coming back to our operation, we had these Tudors, and the registration was AKGAKBA BB BC BD, something like that. And D, the the phonetic at the time was dog, you see, D dog. And so you'd call up Gatow, this is D dog over Fraunhau or something like that, you see. But towards the end, it was getting a bit frivolous, and you'd hear over the RT, Gatow, Fraunhau, woof woof. And Gatto would come back, woof woof, and then they'd know it was D-Dog. But I only wish I'd written down some of these cracks that came over the RT. When the 2-5 was introduced, they put fuel tanks in the fuselage. I think there were 5 of them, something like 100-gallon tanks, so we were carrying about 2,500 gallons. Literally everything had to be taken in by air, obviously. And when we were carrying dry goods, you know, it could be anything. It could be tins of meat or flour or coal and all the rest of it. And if you looked into the logistics, even things like sanitary towels, you know, things you don't normally think of, but of course everything had to be flown in. And then we were flying fuels, and we were going petrol, kerosene, diesel mainly, because that was the biggest demand, obviously. And the interesting thing was that the civilian aircraft were carrying it all. The Yanks wouldn't have anything to do with it. They didn't want to know. I think they were asked at one stage that they would take 40-gallon drums in, but they wanted nothing to do with it. And as I say, it developed into this routine. I went on for over a year in my case.
Did the Russians ever interfere with you?
No. We saw MiGs on one occasion, but we were inside the corridor, so we just sort of pressed on, ignored them, and they ignored us. But then, well, they ignored us, they came close, but it wasn't in any way an interception or a shoot-up or anything intimidating.
Did the German civilians themselves seem impressed or grateful for what you were doing?
Yes, I think so. They were quite friendly. And there was a bit of bartering going on. It was very much frowned upon. I think it was the Control Commission that was regulating all this. And they were dead against it. In fact, they used to issue warnings that anybody found would be heavily fined and jailed. But it still went on. In fact, you see those Stein mugs on there, they were the result of barter. We used to take in cocoa. It was in great demand. So before leaving the country, we'd stock up, go to the local grocer and get 24 1-pound tins of cocoa. And then every time we landed at Gatow, we'd make it obvious that we had some, and somebody'd keep an eye out and make sure there was nobody, you know, no police around or no guards around, and quick swap would take place. Either some of it was sold, we'd sell it for marks, and then some of it was exchange, and I got half a dozen quite nice beer steins.
You mentioned Don Bennett.
Yes.
Did he turn up or play a part in the air?
Oh yes, very much so. He was on his own. He had his own company. Let me think. He changed it quite a lot. There was an air flight and a fair flight. I can't remember what banner he was under, but he had these 2-5s, and he was doing very well.
Any accidents that happened in your personal experience on the airlift?
Not really an accident. The only thing that happened one day was we were struck by lightning. Normally, I don't think I'd have turned a hair, but knowing we had all these extra fuel tanks in the fuselage, it made us hesitate and think for a few minutes. But all it actually did was, when we landed, we went round the tail, and you could see the discharge holes in the tail where the charge had gone out. And we didn't actually see where it struck, but you could see where it had left the aircraft and melted these little holes. It's quite incredible. But apart from that, we ran off the perimeter track and got bogged down one day, but you couldn't call that an accident either. I was there one day when one of the Yorks crashed. I think that might have been one of the Lancashire aircraft ones. I can't quite remember now, but it was one of the civilian companies that were operating out of Gatow, out of Wunstorf, and it was just after takeoff with a full load out of Wunstorf, and he lost an engine. It was pouring with rain, visibility was nil, and there was nothing for it. He had to come down. He couldn't possibly climb out or maintain height. And he just couldn't see a thing. And it so happened that he struck a high tension cable in his descent, and this created such a big flash that in the flash he saw this clearing in the woods. Because all round Wunstorf there are big forests, it's all wooded, pine forest. And there was this one little gap, and he just managed to kick the aircraft round and plonk it down in this clearing. And they all got away with it. And he went on the binge after that. A really God Almighty binge, 24-hour one. And he was going around everywhere and he was saying, God doesn't want us, you know, and knock back another pint.
How did you come to finish with the Berlin airlift yourself?
Well, it was just towards the end. It was ending. I think, was I out there when the actual day it did finish? I could well have been. It just came to an end. I first went out there in September, was it? September,
yes.
48. And my last trip was the following... I just looked that up now. Oh, gosh. Hold on. Here it is.
October 1949?
No, I think it was before that.
No, you put the 7th of August.
July 49. July 49, is it? No, I'm sorry.
7th of August 1949.
That's right. Now, you see, before the airlift started, I'd only just finished my conversion flying onto the York, the Lancastrian, and the Tudor. And British South American Airways was divided into two divisions, East Coast and West Coast. And it was always considered that the plum appointment was West Coast. And I was very pleased when I was made West Coast. But before I ever made a single trip down the West Coast, the airlift came on. And then after about 6 months, they said, well, you know, you've done a fair whack on the airlift, so we'll give you a trip down the line. So it was then broken up, roughly one tour in Germany and a trip down the line. So by the time the airlift ended, which I did the last one, August the 7th was my last one, and then I flew back on August the 10th, and then just reverted to a normal route line. And I think the airlift must have ended just about that time. So it was just back to British South American Airways and no flights with them. I was out, as I can see here, on a trip to Gander on August the 19th, only a week or so after I came off the airlift.